Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Extra Sauce Podcast.
It's my fancy sauce.
I want some fancy sauce.
Yeah.
I'm not done using it.
With the czar of sauces, Greg Hill.
It's my favorite kind of podcast, Mr. Shu. One of the ones in which we are discussing true crime.
I know. You're obsessed.
I am.
I think you were a detective in a former life.
Well, I was able to get away with several crimes in which I stole food from various convenience stores when growing up, so that's right. Probably what it's all about. But I have been obsessed, as have many of you, with The Staircase on Netflix, and that documentary details an incident that occurred in Durham, North Carolina, in which a man named Michael Peterson was charged with murdering his wife when she was found by him, at least that's what he said, at the bottom of a staircase, and she was bloody and it was a horrible scene. And there is an attorney who is joining us today on Extra Sauce named Larry Rudolph. Named Larry, what's his name?
Larry Pollard.
Named, there's an attorney who's joining us today on Extra Sauce named Larry Pollard, who has a theory that I think is the most interesting theory I've ever heard about how Mrs. Peterson actually died.
I think because it makes sense.
Yeah,
it really does.
Yeah, but it's amazing. So those of you who are into The Staircase, you're going to enjoy what our next guest has to say, and it is nice to have you on the show, Larry.
My pleasure. Appreciate the invitation.
I'm addicted to true crime. Well, I'm addicted to Netflix, but I'm also I'm addicted to television, quite frankly, but I'm addicted to true crime, and I was riveted by the story of your neighbors that is told in The Staircase.
Uh-huh.
And I was maybe even more riveted when I learned about your theory about what happened. For those who haven't watched, The Staircase on Netflix tells the story of a novelist, a former mayoral candidate in Durham, North Carolina, who is charged with murdering his wife. His name is Michael Peterson, and he is charged with murdering his wife, Kathleen. His claim is that she fell down the staircase. He goes to court and is, spoiler alert, is convicted. However, you have a theory about what really happened, and it does not involve murder. And I'm wondering how you came about this theory. How did you get started on this theory as a neighbor?
I came across this theory because I happened to be Mr. Peterson's next door neighbor at the time this happened. And I have lived here in this neighborhood for 70 years.
Mm.
And as such, I am acutely aware of the surroundings and some of the wildlife we have here and things of that nature. And just being aware of your own surroundings in your neighborhood, so to speak. Well, in this instance, when this incident happened, I had been a guest at a family reunion 2 years prior to it, where my uncle had hired two ornithologists to come to the family reunion and bring some birds of prey along for a program to entertain the children at the reunion. They had hawks, owls, kites, falcons, all kinds of different birds of prey, and it was a very interesting program, and I watched it out of curiosity more than anything else. And I didn't think very much about it until 2 years or 3 years later when the trial of Mr. Peterson came up. And during the trial at the when it got to the very beginning of the trial, they showed the pictures of the wounds on Mrs. Peterson's head. And I said, my goodness, those look like bird tracks. Mm. And I said, but they're too big to be bird tracks. And then I thought, well, you know, maybe I should call the ornithologist that gave that program for the children at my family reunion and ask her some questions about whether birds of prey hit human beings. And so I did. And in calling them, I didn't tell them that I was looking into a murder case or anything. I just was asking questions for my own enlightenment. But in the process, I found out that when I asked, do birds of prey ever hit human beings? The ornithologist said, oh, yes, they hit them a lot. I said, well, which ones do that? She said, owls. Owls hit people a great deal. And it's called being slammed.
Mm.
And I said, really? And she said, yes, describe your area around where this person was injured. And I said, well, there's a lot of large lawns around there, a lot of large houses. There's a swimming pool around there. And she said, oh, well, that's what we call the grocery store. And I said, what do you mean the grocery store? And she said, all of the birds of prey that are in and around these neighborhoods, they're usually hanging out by a water source. And the reason for that is that little vermin and mice and rats and rabbits and squirrels, all the little things that owls and hawks and things of that nature feed on, also need water. They're just like human beings. They got to have a sip of water. And they know that during the daytime, they get attacked by a hawk. So a lot of them wait until the darkness of the night to run over to a water source, get a drink of water, and then run back into the cover of the bushes or the undergrowth or whatever. And they don't realize it, but the owls are hanging around that water source also, and they're waiting to see the movement. And usually it's the movement of the color white, meaning that they like to find, say, a skunk that walks by, or a rabbit with a white tail, or a squirrel with a belly, or numerous little things of that nature that might reflect light and contrast to the black soil or ground. So they're there to get their meals. That's what is going on in nature. Tell me about owls, and I'm aware that we have those kind of birds in our neighborhood. And do they ever kill people? And well, no, they don't really attack people that much. They hit them and they cut them. They receive people that get hit by owls usually receive large, deep gashes to the back right corner of their head with such force that it usually knocks them to the ground, but doesn't kill them. It cuts them. And as a result, they have bloody gash wounds on top of their head. On top of your head is where you have three large blood vessels. These blood vessels are severed by an owl coming in at around 30 miles an hour and slamming into the back of this person's head and sinking their talons, which are needle sharp, all the way down to the skull bone, which is the hardest bone in the human body because it protects the brain. And they hit the skull bone, they stop, and then they grip. And they have a tremendous gripping force because of a special tendon that's in the lower part of their legs and their elbows, so to speak. And when they hit and absorb the impact, the feet come up, and this tendon pulls in the talons at about 280 pounds of pressure on a needle point, on actually a needle point on each digit. And when this happens, they create these terrible wounds on the back of this person's head, whoever gets hit. Well, I remember that in the evidence that was presented at trial, that the wounds were on the back of her head. This happened at nighttime. There was a swimming pool close by.
Yeah.
I said, there may be some similarities here. I think I'm going to go and see if there's any relevance to my hunch that I might have. And I went out to a local museum we have here in Durham called the North Carolina Museum of Life and Science, but they directed me to the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I went over there, and this is a very, very fine museum, one of the best in the country, and they were very instrumental in helping me formulate what I call the owl theory. Because at this time, I didn't have any real proof. I had to find proof. I just had a hunch. Well, I went down to the library at that particular museum. The first book I opened in their library was a book by a man named Bent, if I'm not mistaken. Bent or Dent, or that's been so long I can't exactly remember the exact name. But he was one of the original book writers in pertaining to wild owls. And when I opened it up, I read the paragraph that said, when owls strike people, they make bloody gash wounds. And I thought, oh, my goodness, this is
what happened to Kathleen.
More relevant.
Yeah.
I was getting some expert testimony from the treatises there. And then they talk about how normally people don't die. They get help, and that's why people don't really die from these wounds. These birds of prey, even though they hit people, they don't really kill people. And owls had never really been the type of bird that kills people, but they do hit people and cut people. And that's what we're trying to say. You have to understand the wounds, and then you can solve this crime.
So she is, Larry, she's outside and going inside, and the owl attacks, and she is injured, and she is bleeding, and she goes inside. And in fact, there is evidence, which we'll talk about in a second, with regard to owl feathers and things that are on her. But then, is it your theory that Kathleen is trying to get help, so then she falls again on the stairs?
The only mistake that was made by the authorities in investigating this case, besides embellishing certain things, was the fact that they got the blood trail backwards. They thought that Mr. Peterson hit her and beat her to death in the bottom of that stairwell, and then went running out of this house for about 40 yards, carrying a 5-foot flexible blowpoke, which is a fire tool, and dripping blood all the way out to the circular drive. Well, when I saw the police videotape that evening that happened, it clearly shows that when the police arrived, they walked down the brick steps from the circular drive, and in front of them is a spot of blood, one small spot of blood on the brick walkway that leads from the circular drive on the Kent Street side of the property, leading towards the back door, which is actually the door that they use as their front door. It's kind of confusing, but if you think about it, it's just a circular drive, and then they go to the main door to the house.
Mm-hmm.
At any rate, they go forward to the landing in front of the front door, and there's another drop of blood on the landing. And there's blood on the outside of the door casing. And when the cameraman walks into the house, he swivels the camera around. There's no blood on any walls or anything there, and there's no distortion, things being turned over, looking like a fight or anything like that. But when he turns it around at about a 90-degree angle down the corridor, about 45, 50 feet, you see Mrs. Peterson, and she is laying in a pool of her own blood. Now, that tells you a lot about this whole incident, is the fact that that pool of blood is the pool that she's sitting in. That's where the blood trail ends, not where it begins. It begins with one drop. Anybody that's a self-respecting deer hunter, Bubbas as we call them here in the South, knows that when you shoot a deer, it runs off most of the time. They don't drop in their tracks. And the way you go and find your deer is to walk over to the spot where that deer was standing when you shot him. And then you start walking the line towards the spot where he went into the woods. Mm-hmm. And along that area right around there close to where he was standing, you will normally find one drop of blood. That is the first drop that comes out of a wound and reaches an edge and drops to the ground. And as you walk that line towards the woods, you will incur another drop, and then more drops. And each drop will give you a little bit more of a hint of what part of the body you hit, how fast the blood is coming out, etc. And then if you continue to follow the spots of blood, you will ultimately get to the body of the deer, and he'll be laying in a pool of his own blood, because that's where all the blood is coming out, and it's pooling there. It's not being spread all around. It's pooling. And the same principle takes effect in this case, and that is the blood trail starts outside, and that puts it in the realm of where the owls are.
Now Larry, the investigators found owl feathers on Kathleen's body, correct?
The investigators did not find them. No, that's not correct. What happened was Mrs. Peterson, when the EMT people got to the house and assumed that she was dead, and she was, and they looked at it and assumed that this had been a beating, there was a rush to judgment of a murder and all this kind of thing, because of all the spots on the wall of blood.
Yep.
Well, that had gotten there because her hair had been soaked with the blood from where she'd been hit outside, and she's running inside of the house and down the corridor to get help, and then she faints into the bottom of that staircase.
Mm.
Now, they put her body into a body bag, and they pull it out of there. You see pictures of it coming out on the gurney from the house, and they put it in a hearse and take it to Chapel Hill, 8 miles away, for the autopsy to find out what killed her. When they get it over there, the medical examiner puts the body on a gurney and opens her left hand and then opens her right hand. And in each of the hands, they find human hairs, and they have been pulled out by the root ball. That's called anagen. And sometimes they don't have a sheath to the bottom of the hair shaft, and that indicates being yanked out by force. Well, when you look at it, the medical examiner says, aha, I think we've got the hair of the killer, and they're going to be Mr. Peterson's hairs. She correctly takes all of the hairs from the right hand and all the hairs from the left hand, puts them in an envelope, seals the envelope, and ships it over to Raleigh, North Carolina, to the State Bureau of Investigation Laboratory to have them analyzed under a microscope. Now, she doesn't know what's on those hairs. She just knows she's got bloody hair. Now, she sends it over there. They analyze it at the lab of the SBI, and in doing so, on the first and third page of the first trace evidence report, the first page evidence, fourth page, it indicates slide 3832. In that, it says, one cut head hair consistent with that of the victim, anagen bloody feather, and it's printed in the English language. You don't have to do any calculating or anything else. I went and I asked the SBI person who did the analysis with the microscope, was he sure that was a feather? And he told me, Mr. Pollard, I've looked at everything there is to look at on the face of this earth in the past 40 years here, and if I tell you it's a feather, it's a feather. I said, thank you very much,
wow.
Mr. Gregory. You are now my expert witness.
Wow.
So from that moment on, we asked to look at that slide, and we came back to Durham and found out that that slide was in the custody of the Durham Police Department. in the locker, evidence locker. We showed it to the district attorney, the reference to that particular slide, and he said he would get it up there for us to look at that very afternoon, which he did. And we looked at it and had to hold it up to the light, fluorescent light, to be able to see a very, very small, infinitesimally small feather that was on this slide.
Yeah.
We've got something here.
Larry.
That is because owls are the only, not the only, but only species of birds of prey that have microscopic feathers. They go all the way down their legs, across their feet, out their toes, to the talons. And they are so small, you can't see them practically with the naked eye. You have to use a microscope. And in doing so, I said, we want to photograph this feather, and we want to put it under a microscope. The district attorney agreed to that. We called in an expert with microscopes, Associated Microscopes Unlimited in Burlington, Mr. Tim Thompson, and he was excellent. Came immediately. We put it under a microscope, and he had no trouble locating the feather. In addition to that, though, he smooths the slide around, and he says, oh, my goodness, look at this. He said, we've got more feathers. And they're over near the edge of the slide. And I said, okay, can you take a picture of this? He said, yes. And he took a picture, and he said, well, we're only at 400 power on the microscope. Would you like to go to 800 power? I said, yes, indeed. That would be interesting. So he pulls up these additional feathers, and you clearly see them wrapped around the hair shaft that had been determined to be Mrs. Peterson's hair shaft. In fact, all of the hairs that that were put in and sent to the SBI were Mrs. Peterson's hairs. None of them were Mr. Peterson's. Now, in looking at that slide and looking at it at 800 power, you clearly see that the feathers are wrapped around her hair shaft. The hair shaft is much bigger in the slide than the feathers are. I mean, that looks like a limb of a tree almost. It's so big. And the feathers, they're wrapped around it, and on top of the feathers, holding the feathers to the hair shaft, are fresh droplets of red blood. I call that my smoking feather.
Now, Larry, I'm going to ask you. Yes. I'm going to ask you to pause for a moment,
sure.
And I want to find out what Michael Peterson thinks about this. I want to find out what David Rudolph, the attorney, thinks about this. But first of all, I want to mention that Extra Sauce is presented by Rodenheiser, and Rodenheiser is far and above the guys that I use when it comes to anything HVAC related, anything electrical related, anything plumbing related. So we're going to take a break and be right back after we hear from Rodenheiser. Rodenheiser is growing and actively seeking to hire teams of experienced HVAC and plumbing technicians as well as electricians right now. They offer endless benefits, full health and dental insurance, a generous 401k plan, 3 weeks paid time off, and even tuition reimbursement. So what can you do? How about heading over to Rodenheiser.com to apply now? Rodenheiser. Quit your job and start a career with Rodenheiser. And now, let's get to the show. All right, Larry, thanks for waiting. So I want to ask you, if this owl attack happened, why didn't Michael Peterson, who was out at the pool, hear it?
I can only say that living here for 70 years, I'm familiar with the territory. I'm familiar with the house. I'm familiar with the area where he claims to have been during this time. And all of the evidence that has been presented at trial, he's very consistent in saying that he was out by the swimming pool. The swimming pool is on the Cedar Street side of that mansion. It is a very, very large house, probably 60, 70 feet. It's 8,000 square feet. Mm. He is on the other side of this house where this occurred, and there was a fountain in the pool which was splashing water out. And that's why the little animals go running around. They hear the water splashing at the grocery store that I talked about. Mm. Now, he stays out there. It is a balmy evening. It's an evening that's so 55 to 60-some degrees, and it's midnight. It's dark. And at that time, when this incident happens, in my opinion, she is on the other side of this large house. She has gone back in after leaving him at the pool to go back and to get ready for a phone call that is supposedly coming in the next morning. She returns down the terrace. She probably picked up the pasta boxes and was going to take them out to the trash cans, the garbage cans, out on the Kent Street side of the house where the garbage cans were located, around on the other side of the circular drive. And when she's moving them around, she gets struck in the back of the head. She does not hear the owls coming because they have feathers on their wings that they fly silently. And then this bird hits her silently, bam, in the back right corner of the head. And she gets up, and somehow or another, in the gripping process with the owl becomes entangled in her hair. It has gripped on her skull, and the lacerations are going down the back of her head, cutting the blood vessels and gripping the hair. Now, this is what is really important. When those owls hit, the legs fold up like the landing gear of an airplane. And that is what pulls that tendon so tight. And when they pull it up like that, or when it just absorbs the shock value, it allows the gripping mechanism to take place, and it also locks the talons. Mm. They have like a ratchet of in their elbows, so to speak, and they cannot open their talons until they get back to the nest and open the talons because they are stretching their legs out straight again, and that releases that locking mechanism. Mm. And that's when they can let go of their prey and start to eat it or cut it up and feed it to their young in the nest. That is key in understanding the mechanics of this whole thing. She has reached up and grabbed that owl by its legs, and the owl is trying desperately to get out of there. Owls are very powerful with their wings, and when they do, they jerk. And when they jerk out, that's how you have so many hairs that have been yanked out by the root ball and are cut, crushed, and broken. All three of those things that a blowpoke could not do. The blood trail starts outside. The police videotape is evidence of that. The blood trail leads clearly into the house, down the corridor. By this time, her hair is soaked. It is like a paintbrush that's been stuck into a bucket of blood. And when she gets to that staircase, in the bottom of it, she turns to see what is coming down the corridor after her, because she doesn't know really what it is that's hit her. It's in the back of her head, on top of her head, but she hadn't really been able to see anything. All she knows is she's in a lot of pain, her hair's being pulled, and she turns around and faints. And when she faints backwards, her head is in a whiplash action, and that slings blood onto the walls. That's why you get 10,000 spots of blood on the wall. Not this beating with a blowpoke, not a fall down the steps. You had to have that head of hair soaked in blood long before it got to that staircase. And that's the missing piece that nobody thought about. That is where her head is being flung backwards from falling backwards into that stairwell and fainting. And she's fainted. She's in the bottom of that stairwell, and she is in an awkward position, leaning up against the bottom wall. You clearly see in the pictures the blood that's coming down in a triangular pattern on that wall. And it's, the wall is just streaming down there. And then the other spots are on the other wall. Now, she lays there for a long period of time, bleeding. And you know that because the police videotape has shown you the pictures of a pool of blood that she was seen sitting in when they got there. Also, you see that she has blood on the soles of her feet and on the heels of her feet. The only way to get blood on the soles and heels of your feet is to step in it. Now, she attempts to regain consciousness after laying there for many, many minutes, losing blood, and she has had alcohol, Valium, and Flexeril in her blood system. And that's a very powerful chemical compound to have at one time. That's why she's under, she's laying there and she's in shock. And they know she's in shock. The evidence from the autopsy report clearly shows the neurosurgeon said that there were red neurons found in her brain slices. And that is a clear indication of low blood pressure and of shock. And that's why he lays there for a long period of time. Now, eventually, though, she does attempt to regain consciousness and stand up. But she's in an awkward position on that floor in the bottom of that stairwell. And she's pushing up against that wall with her right and left arms, the upper part of her arms, the elbows up. She's pushing against that wall trying to get leverage to help her stand up. She's weak. She's under the influence of these things. And she stands up, finally stands up, and when she does, she steps into the pool of her own blood. And when blood is on wood, it's very slippery and gooey. And bingo, she falls backwards again. She slips, goes backwards, hits her head again on the corner of the molding at the bottom of the staircase and gets the very last laceration that is under the crown of her head. In the back, your crown underneath there, where a blowpoke could not have reached nor could have made the pattern that is on her scalp, which you clearly see in the photographs of the wounds.
Larry, were you ever able to discuss this theory with Michael Peterson's attorney, David Rudolph?
I tried to contact Mr. Rudolph, but they were busy preparing for their oral arguments to the jury. And I had called the state bar, the North Carolina State Bar for attorneys, and had asked for an opinion as to what I should do with this evidence. It was getting late in the trial. And I spoke with Alice Mine, who is the ethics expert for the North Carolina State Bar. She directed me to take this evidence to both the defense counsel and the district attorney immediately. And I had to tell her, well, you know, they're making their arguments to the jury right now. I can't go run in and do that. I've got to wait until they are through. And that is exactly what I did. I had met with Tom Maher, who was a co-counsel with Mr. Rudolph, prior to the time that they had given their oral argument. But they were not interested in changing horses at the end of the stream, and I cannot blame them for that. They, I think, acted responsibly, even though this evidence was very powerful and compelling. I couldn't fault them for that. I was trying to, I wished I'd had it earlier and taken it in there, then there'd never been a need for a trial. But I didn't. It took me time to put all of these pieces together. And I put it together from the July 1st start date to the October 8th or 9th end of trial date. And it all began to fit together, and I took it to them. Now, since that time, I had asked to speak with Mr. Rudolph, he had left town after the verdict, and he didn't return for a couple of weeks. But when he came back, we met with him and showed him this evidence. And I could tell he was very interested in it. He was looking at it. He was trying to totally absorb it. And he was sitting there thinking, well, I don't know to give this guy Pollard any credibility or not. And the district attorney, he certainly wasn't going to give me any credibility. The trial was over with. And he's thinking, well, where have you been? After I had taken it to them, they decided they were not going to raise the issues on appeal, simply because none of that had been introduced at trial. And that is correct. They didn't get an opportunity to introduce that at the trial. But after 2 years of waiting through the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court to come back and say this was a fair trial, this, that, and the other, and not getting any relief, Mr. Peterson heard about my idea of the Al theory. He had heard about it from his family members. I'd written an editorial and put it in the newspaper on January the 24th of 2002, and it was on the editorial page with a picture of an owl, and I had told everybody what I was thinking had occurred. I'd been all over town. It had been all over the newspapers, and they were quickly ridiculing the owl theory, writing editorials about searching for the killer owl, and making fun of me taking pictures of owls and putting crosshairs over them on stickers and sticking them on the glass doors down at the courthouse. And the prejudicial pretrial publicity was extensive in this case. It went on and on and on. But at any rate, that be the case, you had book writers that were writing books about this case. You had other TV channels that were, I think, Dateline 2020 did 3 or 4 different episodes on TV about it. And I'm sitting there saying, I brought this forward. I have put it in the newspaper. I have been to a federal judge and asked to get his assistance on this for some of the evidence that I had to compile in this case and be able to legally possess it. I said, I don't know what I can do more than this. And as far as I was concerned, it was a colossal rush to judgment. And it was my obligation, my responsibility, and my duty to bring forth the stuff that I had. I have an obligation because I am his next-door neighbor, and I am a Christian. And I believe that the good book says, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Help your neighbor. Don't bear false witness against him. So I can't go out and lie for him or do anything like that. And because I was a lawyer, a sworn lawyer that I had taken an oath to, and it says that lawyers are ministers of justice, and they must bring forth things that they know in a crime or anything else if they know that is relevant and something that should be brought forward to the authorities. And that is what I did. I did what I think is right and morally right, and I did the right thing. And it's now come into pass that it's taken 16 years for anybody to really pay any attention to it.
Larry, it is a fascinating theory, and the evidence and the work you put into it. Those of us who've been obsessed with the staircase are very, very fascinated with your theory, Larry. And I thank you for joining us and giving us a little bit of extra sauce on the Peterson situation and the Netflix documentary, The Staircase. Thank you.
All right.
So what do you think?
I totally buy his theory. I mean, I've watched most of The Staircase, and just looking at the wounds, explaining the feathers is really what gets
me. Oh, it's amazing.
Since owls are the only ones who have those kind of feathers.
Yeah.
And they're in their clumps of hair.
Yeah.
It's just, I'm...
It's completely believable.
Yeah.
And that's a guy who was found guilty and did 8-9 years in jail.
Right.
For what happened to his wife.
Yeah.
And it wasn't him. It was the bird that did it.
Yes.
As we just heard, it was the bird that did it.
I am very convinced. I'm totally convinced. You know, and I also, if you watch it, I don't know if this is a spoiler alert, you realize there's a bias towards Michael Peterson.
Yeah.
Because he ran for mayor in Durham. He used to write for the newspaper. He didn't say some, he said some, you know, he had some criticisms of some local authorities.
Police-wise, absolutely, yeah.
And,
so, he was a weird dude.
He was eccentric.
He's a weird dude.
And there's other things that I think that could have been biased
that
was dragged out in the press. But this Al thing, I'm totally buying it.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Now we know did the actual crime.
Did you have to end it with a dad joke like that?
I think I did, yeah. All right. Thanks for listening this week to Extra Sauce. We'll be back again with another episode. And if you enjoyed it, please subscribe on iTunes or on Google Play or Stitcher.
Protect your vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.